From theunce.com, this is the Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com.
Hello and welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. We're going to do things a bit differently today. The guest on this episode of the Unce Podcast is David Murphy, former bassist for STS9. Now, the band has been important to me during my career, and David Murphy was a huge part of that for me as well as for the entire fan base. It's been about 9 months now since it was announced that he would be leaving Sound Tribe Sector 9, and we just wanted to explore his background, his years with the band, his departure, and his new musical vision with Seven Arrows, which will be enjoying its debut performance in Chicago this Friday at Concord Music Hall. David was kind enough to be very open and honest, and the conversation flowed beautifully. So I wanted to present it to you uncut, unadulterated, unedited for you in its entirety. Just straight up 75 minutes of our conversation from start to finish. We did record this in my living room here in Denver, and a storm was coming off of the mountains, as it does every afternoon. And the storm clouds were sort of building and rumbling as our conversation got more and more intense. So as we reached the height of the drama of the conversation, you might want to be careful if you're listening on headphones. There's some great ambiance, courtesy of Mother Nature, in there. Anyway, this is a really special interview. Like I said, I wanted it to be completely uncut for the fans to get some sort of closure, to get some sort of understanding what happened, and to figure out how to take that next step, both as fans of STS9 and as fans of Murph. And so I hope you enjoy the interview and enjoy the music from his new Mirrors EP, which was just released today. Here's the interview with David Murphy. We're here in Denver. How long have you been out here in Denver?
I've been in Denver for about a year and a half.
Okay.
I've spent probably 3 or 4 years up in Boulder.
Okay.
Also before that, yeah.
Is it the music scene here that really attracted you? I mean, we got these beautiful venues. Obviously, Red Rocks means a lot to you, but you know, there are so many different clubs like the One Up or Cervantes, the Armory, you know, all sorts of different venues around town. Is it because Denver has become, and it really has only in the past few years, really become such a music town? Is that what really drew you down here?
That has a lot to do with it. I mean, I think the big thing about Denver is, I mean, there's great venues. Obviously, Red Rocks is a great draw and is a great place to play, but there's such a dense concentration of music lovers in this town. Across, I feel like, all genres of music. People like a lot of different genres of music here, but more importantly, they go see music here. Unlike any other town that I've experienced in the U.S., people go out to concerts here across all age groups, across all genres of music.
Regardless of day of the week.
Regardless of day of the week, exactly. People really support the arts here, and especially music. And that's really enjoyable to be around. As a musician and as a music lover, because great shows come through here a lot of times, because you know, Denver is, if you're traveling cross country, if you're a national touring act, you're stopping in Denver if you're going out to the West Coast, or if you're a band from the West Coast heading to the East Coast. It's a great spot to stop. So we get a lot of music here, but the support of the music scene is like nothing else I've experienced in the country here. So I love that. And it gives you the opportunity to be able to, you know, for myself to do a lot. I like doing a lot of different stuff. I like sitting in with people. I like DJing. I like, you know, and obviously to starting the new band Seven Arrows here, it's a great place because so many people support it. But I enjoy doing a lot of different stuff, you know, and not that that's what I'm trying to make my career. You know, it's like I, Seven Arrows is my focus, but I enjoy being able to do this other smaller stuff or sit in gigs. And there's always opportunities to do stuff like that here. And I really enjoy that because I love performing. I love making music, creating music, and I love performing music and bringing joy to people's lives. And, you know, so that's it's important, and it's so supported here.
Absolutely, absolutely, and we will absolutely cover Seven Arrows in depth. But first, I'm wondering, what are you seeing? You know, here in town or around the country, who are the acts that are really grabbing your attention right now? Because there are so many, and it's almost at this point difficult to keep track of who's doing what and who's really pushing the envelope and really, you know, driving music forward. Being a part of that evolution.
The big thing I'm loving right now is I'm loving watching a lot of these producers or more DJ style people, whether it's, you know, like a Pretty Lights, being able to see him bring in the live band aspect, watching the EDM scene start to slowly evolve back to bringing musicians in. I think that that's, as a musician, obviously, I think, you know, I love that aspect, but I'm loving seeing groups doing that right now, just like the, you know, Skrillex had his super jam at Bonnaroo this year, sure. And all these different musicians. I'm love seeing that happening. I know Big Gigantic's going to be bringing out, you know, some musicians at their Red Rock shows.
Oh, wow, and stuff. Okay.
So I'm really enjoying seeing that evolution, or that progression in music start to turn back around.
I talked to this with a ton of people. We saw the pendulum shift 2008, 2009, 2010 to a guy with a laptop, and that's about it. And that's what you see. And now with the pendulum shifting back the other way, and you've been instrumental in this, no pun intended, in helping bring people back and saying, you know, these sounds that we hear from the DJ world, these trends, or more, let's call them genres more broadly, and these flavors we like to hear can be replicated in the band and full band musician world, and they can be integrated with what we've been doing, and that's really where that evolution has been taking place. And you know, I see that with the Pretty Lights Live Band. I see that with the super jams and, you know, that whole thing is just so exciting at this point.
And I think that's, you know, it is an important part of the process. You know, when STS9 had started, you know, putting a laptop or putting a computer on stage was blasphemous in a way.
Sure.
You know, this was, you know, shortly after Jerry dies and Fish is at their climax and the jam band, and just, you know, kind of the end of grunge or soft grunge or whatever's happening in the late 90s, you know.
Sure.
That was, you know, and the technology wasn't quite there yet. But the way that it evolved, it was only a natural progression that people went away from playing instruments and that it went all inside the box, mm-hmm. inside the computer and samplers and stuff like that. And that was that was beautiful and necessary. And I think that it's at its peak right now. I mean, it's peaking. I mean, it's hard for an up and coming band to go out there and make it because festivals, you know, a lot of the more electronic festivals, they don't want instrumentation. They want it simple. They want it, you know, clean.
Yeah.
But, you know, like anything that eventually, you know, once it's hit its peak, it starts to trend back the other way. And I think that we're seeing that. And you're seeing that with even other genres of music now having some of these electronic elements in it.
Absolutely.
You know, whether it's some more indie music or, you know, pop music. And pop music has always had that electronic, you know, thing since Madonna, the days of Madonna or whatnot. But so I think that it's a natural progression to come back towards instrumentation. And but now it's good because now you have this brand new instrument, which is the computer or the sampler, running sequences with your live show that can really expand the sound and it, and all these younger kids and cats now, I mean, you know, they're just doing amazing things. And so it's going to, you know, continue to push the evolution of music and the evolution of art in that way to really open up the sound. And I think it's a beautiful thing, but it's important, I think, culturally for fans to have that, to have real instruments because of what it does, how it can open up the music, you know, and you see that with, you know, with a lot of these, you know, EDM artists starting to add these instrumentation, you know.
Sure.
Just saxophones become the new guitar, if you will, you know.
And on that tip, do you think that the 13-year-old in Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, Florida is asking for a guitar for Christmas, or are they asking for Ableton?
I would think Ableton. I would say Ableton. Definitely over, you know, over the guitar. The guitar is kind of the, pardon my language, but the bastard child right now.
Sure, sure.
But I think that also sways, you know. I think that comes and goes because it's, you know, it's cool to see people having these, you know, everybody's going to have their spin on it. Or
yeah.
As an individual producer, you know, if a lot of the kids that are really good, they have learned on an instrument, whether it's a horn,
Grizz
wind instrument,
saxophone.
Or, yeah, stringed instrument.
Even Skrillex knows how to play the guitar.
Drums.
Capably.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Great, yeah, absolutely. Point, yeah, case in point, you know. So it's about, you know, people adding that instrument over what it is they do or what they think can enhance the live concert.
Absolutely.
Is really what it's about. It's about creating that good energy because at some point with most times that electronic music or the DJ or the producer has come, you know, has become really popular, you know, in more mainstream music, you know, that people tire of that, I think. You know, people like live interaction. I do as a fan anyway, and I think that a lot of fans do. A lot of EDM music, it's new to America. It's new to a lot of these younger kids, so they're fascinated by it. But as your musical tastes grow and evolve, you really appreciate someone up there creating the music for you.
Certainly.
And where the music can go. And as a musician, you enjoy that because you're taking a risk, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not just getting up there and playing predetermined music, you're taking a risk. And risk live allows for magic.
Absolutely.
It's hard to have a magical moment created out of taking a risk when everything that you're doing is predetermined.
You know? Absolutely.
So I think it's important. But where EDM has gone has been very important for, like what you say, these younger kids. I mean, the 13-year-old kid is just bombarded with technology nowadays. So that seems only natural that's the first place that they go is wanting Ableton or Reason or, you know, getting into these soft synths and learning how to really develop music there. And it's great. You know, I wish that I would have had that as a 13-year-old kid, you know.
So what is 13-year-old David Murphy doing? Have you picked up guitar yet? Are you taking piano lessons? What forms the foundation of your sonic core?
For me, it was guitar first, mm-hmm. for sure. I mean, I grew up in a musical family. I mean, dad played guitar, grandmother played, you know, piano in the church, and my granddad was a professional trumpet player and big band leader.
Oh wow!
And you know, he
swing
big band, and he did that until he died, until he was in his late 70s.
I mean, that's incredible.
So he was in three different bands about 6 months before he did, you know. So I grew up around music, and it was never pushed on me or something. This is what, you know, something that you should do, but it was just a natural thing, you know, for me.
And thankfully, it didn't sound like a harebrained idea to want to be a musician.
No.
Having that in the blood.
It didn't. I was always encouraged to you know, to do it. I mean, obviously, like most parents, they don't want you to say, hey, I want to go be a musician because, you know, the likelihood of being successful is up there, becoming an athlete or an
Exactly.
actor or anything. It's very hard
Yeah.
to do. But, you know, at the same time, like anything else that you're going to be successful at, it takes a lot of hard work. It's not glamorous. You know, it's something that you have to be passionate about and have a real love for. So, but now I got into guitar and And by the time I started to be in high school, obviously there was a lot of other people who played guitar and whatnot. And you know, I had a buddy who was like, you know, you're always the rhythm guitar guy, and you're not very good. So maybe you should think about playing the bass.
You know?
And picked up a bass and fell in love with it.
So there's no classical training. There's no hours and hours
self-taught.
Of theory.
I mean, I've probably had, you know, a couple of lessons here or there, but no classical training. I mean, I got into it and was self-taught, and then kind of as I went along, you know, I got once I really was like, this is what I want to do. And shortly before Sector 9, I mean, I spent a year and a half just working a job, and every spare moment was playing the bass, learning the bass, just trying to get my head around it all. And over the years, it's just been picking up knowledge from, you know, people like Dave Schools and O'Teal and
sure.
other people that you meet, run into, and your other contemporaries.
O'Teal Burbridge sees you playing. Would he know that you don't have that theoretical background? Have you sort of self-taught in bad habits, or at this point, have you streamlined your craft?
No, at the time that I remember the first time we met O'Teal, we were playing play Smith's Old Bar. We were doing a monthly there in Atlanta, and he was hanging out because a lot of the guys from Aquarium Rescue Unit hung out there at the time. And, you know, he wanted to sit in and just hops up on stage and just shreds over what we do, you know. And
wow.
So, of course, he sees that we're young, but that's, you know, a lot of my personal music success and success of STS9 at the time was coming from a lot of these elder musicians, you know, wanting to pass along, you know, their knowledge, not
yeah.
only of playing the music, but also of the touring, the business side, and I think that left a huge impression on me from the standpoint that I had always recognized that the future of music is always with the youth,
mm-hmm.
and that art and music is not competitive. For as much as the business people or journalists or whoever, you know, try to portray it in that way, or it can be, you know, it's not,
mm-hmm.
you know, if it takes a village.
Sure.
You know, you have to, it takes all of us being successful to grow music and to grow art, especially live music. And so that left an impression on me to where I always wanted to be helping out other people coming up or younger artists, especially as Sector 9 got more popular, was wanting to make sure that these younger unknown acts were getting brought onto our shows and our concerts and our tours, because it's about nurturing that and continuing the growth of music and whatever you can do to help other people to grow.
Did you see that as a function of the jam world in the sense that musicians like to get together and share their knowledge and just shred and grin and like play with their buddies?
Absolutely.
Do you see that more in that jam world? And then, you know, I guess
Absolutely.
Compare that to now where people, you know, producing a track would love to get their buddy on the track or have them remix
yeah.
it and see it as a direct correlation.
It's a direct correlation. It's the same thing, I think, you know. And that was... and fortunately or unfortunately, you know, later in, that was always something that Sector 9 was not good at. STS9 was not good at collaborating
mm-hmm.
for some reason. You know, I very much enjoyed it, you know, but it was always a sore subject, I guess, with us.
Yeah.
You know,
Bringing in other instrumentalists to a
yeah,
show.
Yeah, exactly.
In the studio
sitting in
as
with
well.
Other people, yeah. You know, not everyone was open to that. And
mm-hmm.
and that can be a hindrance, you know, because that music is about that collaboration and
sure.
it is about that creating. You know,
yeah.
it's not a marriage. I mean, it is a marriage, but it's not monogamous.
You know?
Music is about playing with other, and that's how you grow.
Uh-huh.
That's how you get better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you like any other profession or hobby or whatever it is that you do, if you don't have anybody to push you and to challenge you or to show you new ways of doing things, it's hard to grow, you know? If we just do things how we want to do it all the time, you know, we'll create something cool, but we also, that's what we do,
yeah.
you know? And we don't push ourselves outside of that box to grow and to learn, you know? So I think it's important.
So let's rewind a little bit. You're going to school in Athens. Is that where you meet the guys?
Just living there.
Just living there.
No, I mean, I I'd known a couple of the guys since high school.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and that was pretty much, you know, moving to Athens was just a way to get out of Atlanta where we grew up in the burbs.
Yeah.
You know, and to be around more, you know, creative. Athens at the time was great, you know, place to be.
Sure.
And it still is.
Yeah.
For music.
Absolutely.
It's a great place to be. But we were nurtured there, mm-hmm. you know, as musicians and as a young band. Friends and just, you know, people who run venues and stuff who had a lot of success helping to break people like REM and the B-52s and Widespread,
sure.
and who had a lot of great knowledge about how to handle yourself in the business world, you know, and not overplaying and playing the right places and doing the right things that were really important, you know. Being successful takes as much work as you have to put into the artistic side. Your music has to be great first, your band has to be good first, but you also have to be smart about how you go out there and sell it to the world.
You know. Who are you looking to at this time in the late 90s? Who do you have a picture up on the wall and say, this is who's doing it right now, this is what we're trying to do? Or did you even have a concept of what that was?
I don't think we did, you know, I personally didn't really have a concept of that. I knew what I loved, you know. But I think, you know, what made SCS9 successful was that we all kind of liked a little bit different things,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
I was more the rock, you know, harder edge guy.
Okay.
You know? Never really was super, you know, my experience with the jam world came from being in Sector 9.
Right.
Not from previous and saying, this is what I want to do. You know, to where some of the other guys, they had come from that world.
Okay.
You know? So it was just a nice meeting of the minds, you know, of where everybody was coming from. And the instrumental thing was just, you know, at the time, you're just kind of burnt from all the shit that had happened through the course of the 90s.
Sure.
I guess, you know, and it was just like, okay.
Time to shut up and play.
It's time to shut up and play. You know, we're going to be inspired by tons of, you know, fusion jazz and acid jazz and,
sure.
you know, Herbie and the Headhunters and Weather Report and Can and all these bands who had done it in the 70s and been really inspired by that, you know. And people who were in more of the jam stuff, you know, it was like, you know, you liked some of these bands, but you were like, you didn't like them when they started singing. You know, we won't name any names, but
no comment. No comment.
You know, but the music's great, but you know, you can take or leave the lyrics.
Sure.
You know, it's for some people, it's not for some people. So
yeah.
I think because music is so universal that, you know, when you remove language from it, it really becomes that much more universal.
I believe so. Yeah.
You know, I have, you know, it's strange for as the scene that STS9 was in, you know, I have some very religious family members who their kids also love the music, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's no verbal message there to say that this music is about one thing or the other. You know, it's about whether you enjoy the music or not.
And a fan can come up to you and say, this helped me get over a heartbreak, and the other one says, this pumps me up for
exactly.
work or whatever.
And it's not political, it's not religious, it's not spirit, you know, it's
human.
It's what, exactly, it's human. It's what the listener takes from it. And I think that was awesome for so long,
yeah.
you know? That was great to experience that, but then you find that also has its limitation. You know, they both have their limitations and they both have their you know.
Sure. Now at this point, you know, you're getting some success. You've developed a sound, or you are developing a sound. Who is bringing that dance music aesthetic into what you're doing? Who's introducing that either through their playing or through, hey, have you heard the new Aphex Twin or whatever? How does that become such a part of who you are? Because I see Sector 9 as being that bridge that brought a lot of people from the jam world over into this, you know, you don't want to call it EDM world because a lot of us are still outside of that niche. It's this festival circuit that melds the jam acts with the electronic acts and the ones who really put a value on musicianship and production. So I wonder, you know, how does that sort of slowly become more and more a part of what the band is and what it becomes?
You know, it, I think it was a progression to some degree of just exploring music and always, you know, wanting to push yourself and to reach out there to listen to new musics and new genres. For myself, I had always been into dance music. I had an older sister who was really into the, I guess we'll call it the rave scene of the early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because she was, you know, older than me and got some years on me now. But so I was introduced to it at 14 or 15 years old. You know, she was dating guys who were working with 808 samplers.
Wow.
And creating kind of more industrial goth dance music. You know, so I had always... Not that I was always, well, I was always into it, but I'd always been around it. And mm-hmm. there was a point in my life where I very much did love that, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of that deeper house, the Detroit sound from the 90s, you know? So
sure.
I'd always loved that, but it never really thought about creating that style of music, you know? But as, you know, you start to push those boundaries of being an instrumental group, you know, you can only really play so much fusion and funk music,
sure.
You know, before it just, not it becomes bland, but you need to start pushing those boundaries, you know, because, you know, while funk music is great and that acid fusion, that jazz fusion is great, you know, it's been done, and
yeah.
you're not creating anything and pushing the boundaries. And as attention spans get shorter with people, and as technology really starts to blow up, and the internet starts to blow up, and you know, the early, you know, 2000s and whatnot. I think it was a natural progression. For me, I'd always been into it as other guys in SCS9 started to get into these other type of world, you know, electronic worlds. And we started getting into the Prefuse 73s and the Telephone Tel Aviv.
Sure.
You start meeting these guys and hanging out with these guys. You start learning new techniques and, you know, you start listening to music in a different way and what you can do with it, with instrumental music, especially once the technology of laptops, Ableton is introduced, you know. I mean, we use Reason for a while on stage, but you know, as the software and the technology catches up, then you find that you can start to introduce new things, sequences, these sounds that, and these rhythms and these patterns and textures that that you can't necessarily perform live to the ability that they need to if you're performing in front of people.
Sure,
you know, and you want to put on a performance and a concert and not just play your songs on stage, you know, the more it becomes about the artistic presentation, you want to get it right and you want it to be perfect. So I think that's where a lot of that seeped in. You know, there was no really one style. I mean, obviously we got into drum and bass for a while and mm-hmm. more house stuff, but you start to listen to a lot of different stuff and it all starts to just slowly infiltrate its way into your songwriting, into your process.
It's funny because, you know, if you put everything on a spectrum, you would say that STS9 definitely had a darker sound. It wasn't in a lot of that sunny, happy jam segments of the sonic spectrum. And that's funny, you know, you mentioned coming up on the goth and industrial. Do you wonder, was it ever intentional that it was a sort of darker, not quite brooding, but definitely, you know, like a darker sound that the band had?
I think that probably a lot of the... once again, that was a result of us having different influences. You know, Dave Phipps, the pianist and keyboardist, you know, was trained and did love playing in that beautiful, you know. But when he does that beautiful, pretty major stuff,
mm-hmm.
and I lay the darker undertones of the bass lines, you know, playing in different modes and doing things to darken it up, it gives you this real kind of...
Well, it's balance is what it is.
Balance, exactly. And I think that was totally unconscious, but it was just something that just became a part of, you know, because I like the darker stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. I love it being pretty. I love getting pretty, but, you know, you can't live in that world. And you can't live in the dark world.
Yeah.
Life is about that perfect balance. And I think art is definitely about creating that perfect balance between the dark and the light, you know. And the marrying of those, it just creates something beautiful that really hits a chord, I feel like, inside of people. And while we were able to be instrumental because of those emotional swings that we could create within a song, or within a sound, or within a part.
Tell me about the Blasphemy. Let's explode this. When do you first bring a laptop on stage, and what sort of got you to that point?
It was at first a desktop.
I dragged a desktop on stage.
I remember when the sound guy at the club, the guys, like, we were high. We probably were a little high, but, you know, I mean, they, yeah, it was interesting, you know, tubed monitor. And, you know, but it was, you know, that was something that Hunter and Phipps really got into, you know, once Reason came out. And Dave Phipps is this incredibly smart guy and very, technically advanced. You know, I went to Georgia Tech, and, you know, it was something he was always into and wanted to, you know, and as a keyboard player, just kind of makes sense that once this technology starts to catch up and these programs come out, he really delves into that world. And he brought a lot of that, you know, and Hunter jumped onto that and really latched onto that. I'm not sure if that was just out of being bored with guitar or what it was that he felt like he needed to delve into that world, but they both did. And as songwriters, which, you know, a lot of times your guitar players and your keyboards are the more songwriter, they're writing the melodies and whatnot. And so they really enjoyed that and wanted to incorporate that into the show, you know, being able to add these textures and layers and things that at the time you necessarily, you know, the trigger systeming wasn't there to be able to do it. For us, it seemed like the easiest way to do it while continuing to play our instruments.
Right.
And of course, you know, Apple comes out with the G4 laptop, and, you know, so we were able
off
to start
the races.
Off to the races, you know, exactly. And then, you know, it was something that we all, you know, and then it kind of just trickled down to everybody. You know, it was like, I realized that you could create bass tones and bass synth. You could do things that traditional stomp box floor pedals or rack mount effects units for the bass, they just couldn't do it, you know? And for me, loving playing the bass, I got to the point where I had diluted my bass tone through trying, you know, I was like, you know what? I just want a bass to sound good.
Mm-hmm.
Nice, clean, warm, you know, good. Maybe a phaser pedal, maybe a flange, maybe a fuzz pedal, but that was it. And so I wanted to jump into getting into the soft synth world. And at the time, you're looking back, it was a huge mistake. I should have just bought a dope analog synth. I didn't need a stupid computer. You know, and eventually with Sector 9, that's where I got. You
yeah.
know? I mean, the last 3 years of FCS9, I'd never had a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Which was funny because I always had people yelling at me to put my computer up. But I was like, I don't have one. But, you know, but that was where it was. It started from was willing to be able to create, you know, new bass tones while keeping intact the bass guitar as the bass guitar. And then that really opens you up. It opens up the sound. It enables you to do more things, to play different styles and genres of music while keeping true to those forms as well.
Certainly. You know? And as you are evolving on stage, which is, you know, a band of your ilk, that is really where you shine. What's this doing to the songwriting process? Because is it as easy or easier to improvise when you have all these tools at your disposal? Or does that sort of box you in when you're working with that much technology?
At first, it blew the doors off and opened everything wide open. But over the course of time, it really stifled the songwriting, you know? It put it in a box. It put all these limitations on it and really confused the whole thing to where there was no more sitting in a room with each other jamming, writing ideas. It was someone writing in the box on their own time and bringing these ideas to other people, you know? And then wanting, you know, and then you start to battle what I probably a lot of bands or people who have the computer on stage running sequences run into is that then you're fighting for, well, the computer's playing my part, you know?
Yeah.
Well, what am I supposed to, now I'm just supposed to sit here and play this one part because you've got two other keyboard players or two other keyboard sounds coming out of the computer.
Right.
You've got bass lines coming out of it. You got drum parts. And the next thing you know, you've lost, like what I was talking about earlier, you've lost all chance to create that magic because everything becomes structured.
Sure.
There's no more room for, everything is predetermined, you know? And while that's really important to put on a great concert, when you're selling out Red Rocks, when you're, you know, doing 4,000 or 5,000 people at night, it's very, very important to be making sure the integrity of the concert is on point and that 75% of the time you know exactly what's going on.
Right.
But you need that 25% of the time.
You need that spark.
You need that, and the fans need that room for experiment, you know, for the risk.
Yeah.
You got to take the risk. I love it at a show when I see them fuck up.
Sure.
And I see them find their way out of it. And that's where the magic happens.
Jamming out of a hole.
Jamming out of a hole, brother. That's right. And when you lose that, you start to lose the fans. You know what I mean? It starts to become stale and mundane to perform. You know, when you've come from a place where you started to where 80% of your show is improv because you only had we only had an hour of music, but we were playing 3-hour concerts. You know.
Yeah.
So it's hard, you know, it was from one extreme to the other. You know, and somewhere in the middle in there, it was incredible.
Is that where the Axe the Cables concept comes about? Because you had become so tied into this technology that it was time to really refocus and see each other and interact with your instruments and be able to
absolutely.
Really, you know, purely do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that was a big part of it. And at the time, our manager really pushed us to, you know, he saw that going down the rabbit hole towards, you know what I mean, zero connection with our roots, you mm-hmm. know, and that was an important way to get back to it, you know. I mean, we were at a place where, you know, you didn't really know what was happening, you know.
Yeah.
Well, we'd play 5 songs and Hunter would never pick up his guitar.
Right.
You know, and that, for the fans, that's what he said, you know, where did the blasphemy start? You know, it's like, it started there, but that's where when it really happened, you know, when you stop playing your God-given talent on your real instrument.
Yeah.
You know? So Axe the Cables was a great way to...
hit the reset button,
hit
really.
The reset button, yeah. You know... Yeah, that was really important, and was a lot of fun, and was probably will go down for some of our really lifelong fans as some of the best stuff that we've ever done. You know, for me, it was some of the most enjoyable. You know, because I've always, you know, I've never wanted to get away from the improving on stage, never wanted to give away from the taking a risk, like. I don't care that we're at Red Rocks. Why can't we get on stage and
go for it?
Here we are.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, because that's what got you to that point.
KSC, Funk Jam, let's go. You know?
Yeah.
You've been a professional musician for 17 years. You know? You ought to be able to get up there and just do that. When that is, you know, we're not an indie folk band. We're not a punk rock band. You know, that's where we started from. Mm-hmm. We started from just being able to get on stage in front of people and let the crowd dictate where it goes.
Jam's not a bad word for you.
No, you know, I've never wanted to do that, but that is important. If you can't just get in the room with people and just jam, you know, that's why, you know, one of the first things as a musician you learn is just some standard blues riffs, because everybody knows those, and anybody can get in a room and just play some standard blues.
Right.
And you're just creating. You're just, you know, and wherever it goes, it goes. But that's the beauty of standards. They're there so that it's the universal language. You don't even have to know that you can have met this guy or girl 15 minutes ago and you can jam with them.
You can do 12-bar blues. We can get this done.
Yeah, yeah. Or you can do some variation of it,
sure.
Or jazz or whatever that may be. You know what I mean? But you have this basis to pull from, and that's really important. And jam or funk music is the same. You know, I believe, you know, mm-hmm. you should be able to just to get it, especially with people who you've been playing with for 20 years, you know, making
absolutely.
Music. And it was a, you know, that was, you know, and I, even for a lot of fans, I think that was a real turning point when we stopped doing that and we wouldn't allow ourselves to play that style, you know, to even give ourselves the opportunity to do that on a nightly basis. You know.
And from the Grateful Dead through Fish, through your buddies in Umphrey's, you know, at some point in the career, they make that album with the 3-minute songs on there. And they focus on, you know, songwriting and lose that improv, what really drew the fans in, either to, you know, evolve for their own sake, which we've, you know, established here that evolution is necessary. But, you know, in losing that, does that put you in the position of the fan, like, you know, I love these journeys. I love, you know, the band without Annette going out there and really taking that risk. Is that, you know, where you see the wheels coming off to a certain extent?
For me, absolutely. You know, yeah. It's where the wheels come off. When your journey and when your experience and why you're doing it is no longer for the fans, and it's for your own personal satisfaction or your own security blanket of the paycheck, the machine that you've created, the worst thing that can happen to you as an artist is being comfortable.
Sure.
The worst thing that can happen for you as an artist is a steady paycheck.
That's the worst thing. You see comedians get rich and suddenly they're trying to make jokes about being in limos or,
you know. You're not funny anymore.
You're not funny because you're not scrapping.
It's not about making it. It's just about, you have to remember that, and especially after a long career, you know, the bands who really are able to have these long, successful careers are ones who understand who their audience is, who their fan base is, and catering to those people and making them happy, because you're not going to reinvent yourself 17 years later. You're going to evolve, you're going to grow, you're going to be influenced by new things, and most of the times a fan base is open to that, you know. But you can't dig up your roots and try to replant yourself in someone else's yard as a mature oak tree. You know, you've grown there, you've grown it organically, it's happened for you naturally, and you have to respect and appreciate that you have that what you have and that you've made it there. And you have to respect the people who have dedicated their life or their musical love to what it is you do. And you have to respect that. And the day that you lose that respect, the day you become comfortable with what you have and you're just like, you know what, I just want to play enough shows to get paid and I just want to stay at home and satisfy my own creative needs and my own creative desires, you know, to me, you've just gone down the wrong path. And this is not, and that's just not something that I've ever wanted to do. It's always been about, music for me is about creating music for those fans. It is about trying to provide some spark of beauty and reprieve and from the hardships of life for these people for these couple hours, you know? Because I know what that does for me to go to a great concert for a band I love. It's the reset button. And if you can provide that for people, you have to honor and respect that and not take that for advantage and not just say, okay, now this is my thing. I'm gonna go do it, I'm gonna get paid. You know,
especially for a band, unlike 99% of others, whose fans identify themselves as being a part of this family,
as a part of
this idea.
It is a family.
And,
yeah.
You know, flying cross country, spending months on tour with you guys.
Spending thousands of dollars of their hard-earned money to do this. And they have expectations. And while we shouldn't have expectations in life, like I say, they allow you to take risks. Mm-hmm. They understand that, okay, you know, they're going down this road. Just like we were into reggae, we were into drum and bass, we were into dance music, you know. So you're allowed that as an artist, but you can't then not play those songs that they love. Or you can't just handpick a few of them that you're satisfied with. You know, for us, you can't just pick the Circus and the Baraka and the 4-Year Puma and say, okay, we've got six or seven songs that we had from when we started the band. We're just going to play those, and people will be, you have to, you know, continue nurturing that side of yourself, mm-hmm. and also writing stuff like that. You know, people want to hear the guitar. You know, people want to hear the piano solo. People want to, you know, they want to see the bass guitar. They want to, you know, still have that. They don't want all that coming out of the computer. They don't want just the house beat, the sequences, the, you know, just because that you're into something as an artist, you can't reinvent yourself as a band to become that. You know, you have to pay homage to everything that you are, and what, and the reason that we did have such a unique sound was because we always incorporated all those elements, you know, and kept and stayed true to them, you know.
To that end, you know, January of this year, we get the news that you will be leaving the band. How about that for drama?
That was apropos. That was fitting. The gods are angry.
To that end, you know, someone who is such a part of the fans' lives, fans who have really devoted their mind and body and spirit to this band, to make a decision like that, which obviously is not easy, and must have been coming, and there must have been ways to, you know, to deal with that as was happening. But walk us through that process, or as much as you can, or as much as you feel comfortable. Walk us through that decision to part ways with the band, because, you know, it does leave a hole in the fans' hearts, and that's something that you probably did not take lightly. So, you know, to be able to sort of unfurl that would be great, and would give fans a lot of perspective on a decision like that, which not many people make a decision like that, and one that impacts so many people.
It was, and you know, like you said, the hardest part of making that decision was the way that I knew that it would affect the fans. You know, obviously it left a huge hole in my heart. That was my family, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. So all I've known, you know, had lost a lot of relationships with my own
brothers
family
and
friends out of pursuing this dream and keeping this dream alive, not only for ourselves, but also for the fans and the community.
Yeah.
You know, and for myself, you know, being the most outspoken in the band, being the front man of the band, being, you know, the face of the band, if you will, as far as always interacting with the fans. Like I said, I will always be, for me, it's all about the fans, because I am also a music fan.
Right.
You know, and I always want to respect that and honor that. But it was not an easy decision to make. And it was not something that was just some rash decision. This had been about a year, you know, in the making. You know, I think, you know, after I had gotten, you know, sick a number of years back, you know, in 2011, you know, it that had left a lasting impression on me.
It puts things in perspective.
It puts things in perspective. It made me, you know, want to, I don't want to say simplify what it was we did, but, you know, and going through, you know, a life-threatening illness or whatnot, you can never expect anyone else to understand what you've been through. So I recognize that going into it. But for myself, it did make me look back all the way back to my child, but it made me, at Sector SCS9's career, made me look back to our roots. Why was I here? And what was it that I loved about what I did, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe at some point that didn't line up with what other people's visions were for where we were at in our career or where we were going in our career. But, you know, there just became a steady decline in personal relationships, you know, in agreeing on how to move forward and how to function as a band, both artistically, you know, as a business.
Sure.
You know, for me, I saw us in a place where it was like, I just, you know, I wanted to respect what it was we had always done. And I felt like we were in a great place, and why not be out there just touring as much as possible, playing for the fans as much as possible, really delving into the music career that we had already had.
Right.
And really honoring all that and giving the fans what it is they had always asked for, which was, you know, a nice version of the Axe the Cables. And of course, some of the younger fans, they love the electronic dance. You're not going to, but really having and finding this nice balance and continuing to also write in that vein.
Yeah.
You know, and for whatever reasons, that just didn't line up with what everyone wanted to do at where everyone wanted to go. You know, and not that I was the odd man out by any stretch of the imagination. There's five people, you've got all these different, you know, everyone has different relationships with everyone else. Everyone has different things they want to do. But at the end of the day, you know, over the course of the last, 2013, I guess, it just got bad, you know, personally, started to affect how we were performing on stage, the mental space. Can't speak for everyone, but that I was in, it put me in a place to where providing that sanctuary for the fans, it wasn't there for me mentally anymore, you know?
And getting a parking ticket before you go on stage could absolutely, you know, destroy your performance. Having that sort of permanent cloud over your head couldn't have been, you know, doing wonders for your playing.
I'm not really concerned whether it's too much information or not, but it's like, you know, there was someone in the band who wanted me out of the band. Not to say, I took the public hit, I guess, for being the one to leave the band.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was shown the door, I guess. You know, there was, you know, and someone had been saying in the band for well over 9 months that it was me or him, but that someone was leaving the band.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was out of the fact that I didn't live in Santa Cruz and that I lived here, you know what I mean? That it ended up, you know, being framed in a way that, you know, that was the decision that was made. But, you know, it was going in a direction that no longer satisfied my artistic needs and desires. And then to have all of these personal battles going on and not getting along with people, I found myself angry on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I found myself hating it. And
the antithesis of creativity.
And I had always said that I would never, no amount of money or security or glamour or ego would allow me to continue doing something that I did not enjoy doing and that I felt like I was a detriment to the shows or to the fans, you know, or to the music, more importantly.
Yeah.
So that was, it was a hard thing to have to make that decision, you know, the canceling the tour. It's like, I didn't want to do that, but, you know, I was always the one to try to make things work. Let's make this happen smoothly. You know, the fans shouldn't suffer, but sometimes people's egos just get the better of them, you know? And I hate that. I don't hate it. I mean, I understand it. I am an entertainer who gets on stage in front of people, and people are going to critique you. They're going to, you know, be upset with you when you don't do things the way they want. And I know that.
Especially fans of this brand.
Especially fans of this band. Or this brand and this genre.
Sure.
I mean, there's no other really genre of music that people love hating on their musicians like the pseudo Livetronica jam scene. But that's okay. I mean, that's their right. You know, they like I said earlier, they spend their hard-earned money. They really base their lives around this music. And so they have the right to do that. And I respect that. And you know, so I hate that, you know, that I was the fall guy for it or that appeared that way. But, you know, at the same time, I'm fine with that because I know in my heart that I was trying to, you know, I know that the fans, you know, Murph's the one with the drug problem. Murph's the reason that they do all this electronic stuff. But it's funny because it's the opposite. You know, I don't have the computer on stage. You know, I don't. You know, that wasn't me. It wasn't me in control of that world. And
it's funny. But, you know, you look at message boards, you look at comments, you get the praise, you get the hate.
You get the hate, and I'm fine with that. You know, it's like I know where my heart lies. You know, it's like I have to be happy with that at the end of the day. And you know. And I because of that, you know, I wasn't going to exist in a world full of negative. And you can't. I mean, a band has to be a family. And when that starts to deteriorate, for as much time as you spend with each other, for the way your lives are intertwined, there's just you just can't. You can fake it, and bands have done it. You know, a lot of bands have done it because, you know. People have mortgages, people have kids, people have lives, and people just assume not get along and have different dressing rooms and buses and all that, and I get all of that, but, you know, for me, that's not what it's about, you know, and I've always wanted to be involved with music that has lyric, that has songwriting with vocalists, with... I've always wanted to explore that realm of creating music that's based in that structure because of what it does to the music. You know, and I've realized that recently. Now writing songs that are set up for vocalists or for instrumentalists who will solo, and you can have, you know, what all of a sudden, you know, how it's just completely different than everything I've done for my whole musical career.
Sure.
And I've always wanted to do that. I've always loved songwriting,
yeah,
you know. It's a shame that it's happened this way, but art is about growing and evolving, and you know, it still hurts me to. I mean, those are, you know, 130 amazing songs that we created together. And honestly, it's like I'm happy that they're still doing that.
I think you're a fan of STS9 as it exists now, and
I mean, I have not listened to any of it, and obviously, there's a little
bit
of
a
bad. Yeah, it's still a little, it's still a fresh wound, but it's not about those guys. It's not about me. It's not about whoever they get to play bass. It is about the fans and them being able to enjoy that art. You know, I mean, Picasso isn't alive, but people still love his work, you know? And that goes true for any art or any great thing that has been created, whether it's the telephone or the car or anything else, you know? These things transcend the people that create them. And for me, the music that STS9 created, that I was a part of, it transcends anyone in that band. It transcends myself. It transcends anything that was created. It's about the people who will enjoy that music. You know, yeah, it would be a detriment to the world if people still couldn't go see that music, whether I'm in the band or not. You know, I don't enjoy that or take, you know, any sort of satisfaction in the way that it happened or that I'm not in that band anymore. You know, it's something that was my whole adult life, you know. But you know... You can never let those things hold you down in life, and I know that, you know, creating beautiful music and creating great music is more important than who you do it with or what the name is. You know, if you're continuing to create music that people love and that people gain enjoyment from, that's all that matters to me. It's not about the money. It's not about the size venue. It's not about your light show or all this stuff. You know what I mean? It's about creating great art, and that's all that's really important to me, you know. So I'm looking forward to doing more of that, you know.
To that end, you know, in the months leading up to this Seven Arrow show hitting the Concord in Chicago on September 5th, tell me what your next step was musically. You know, you spend this entire adult life in this band, and now, you know, you've got this sort of blank slate to work with. What was important to you, first of all, in saying, okay, this is my new musical endeavor? You know, what did you see as important pieces of that? And not only the pieces, but the sum of the whole. What was that direction that you were looking towards with your new musical project?
I knew immediately that it was vocals, you know, and that it was writing music that wasn't just, you know, and not vocals in the EDM sense of sampling some female or male vocalist and cutting up their vocals and putting it over songs that I had written. It was actually writing lyrics.
Alive in the flesh vocalist,
singing
writing
it,
songs.
Doing it, harmonies, melodies, that, you know, really pushing the envelope as far as that world. But taking that and not just trying to write pop music, you know, was still keeping with the aesthetic that that is me as a musician, first of all.
Right.
You know, so people are like, well, you know, is it anything like SDS9 or this or that? I'm like, well, I'm not going to reinvent myself.
Right.
You know, I will continue to write music that, and you know, write bass lines. But, you know, a lot of this stuff, I mean, I wrote really all of it and then had other musicians help me out with it. But, you know, it's going to be still in the vein of who I am as an artist and as a musician and as a person. But
sure.
That was the immediate thing, was I knew that I wanted to work with a vocalist, you know.
Tell me about the vocalist you're working with now.
She's amazing. Her name is Ashley Niven. She has a great little story. She was in a teen pop band from like 13 to 17 years old from Tampa. And they had a pretty fair amount of success.
You okay.
know, opening for NSYNC and Britney Spears and Destiny's Child, you know. Had a lot of, you know, they were young.
Sure.
But so she had been singing, performing on stage since she was maybe, I don't know, 9 years old or whatnot.
Oh, wow.
With these same girls. And so, but, you know, they maybe were a little later into the boy girl pop band thing. So that came to its end probably when she was 17 or so. And, you know, went on her journey. I met her out here through some local musicians, and she had maybe in the last year or two had started getting back into singing and, you know, had evolved into a grown woman and amazing singer. But she had had that that pop sensibility, you know.
Right.
She understood that whole, you know, darker side of the music business, the pop world, the
sure.
put a bunch of money into an artist, they never get anything, the music, you know, the image, just selling this thing. So it was really cool to be working with somebody who really was just all about the music, but they had been through that machine. There was no, they, as like I understand, there's no glamour
right.
in it. There's no, you know, there's no just overnight success. You have to create great music and you have to work hard at it and do something that you really believe in for it to be successful, you mm-hmm. know, and for people to enjoy it. So she's great. And we, you know, just immediately hit it off, both from what we like musically and where we wanted to go as far as writing lyrically.
How important is it that she's from a completely different world and maybe has no concept of where you're coming from or preconceptions
well,
about where you're coming from.
Well, she does, though, because she had, you know, through her journeys in life, she had gotten into, you know, electronic music
okay.
or the jam band world or, you know what I mean? She had gone through her journeys with that. So she was familiar with that whole style of music, but, you know, but that was the great thing. She understood, she now, you know, like myself, has this understanding of a lot of different genres of music and has created an identity, you know, and a personality and a point of view,
mm-hmm.
which is very important. But you're also right, you know, it's like, it's good to have someone who's also coming at the music side from a different side of it, you know.
Right.
She's not, as far as the you know, the behind-the-scenes side is not, you know, comes from a different world than I do. So
yeah.
It's good to have that. It's just great to have a fresh perspective.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Great to have someone who's hungry and young and excited and, you know, but more importantly that you know, we really have a real connection as far as music and more importantly, lyrics,
mm-hmm.
you know, and content and, because for me, that's so new. So to be working with someone who has experience, but also just doesn't want to say You know, just don't want to get up there and sing party, party lyrics like as a lot of stuff. You know, it's funny, the jam world went to the electronic world, and there's no more niceties or hippie vibe going on. It's all about party, party, get fucked up, you sure. know. It's all about right now and who get, you know. There's not a lot of astral stuff going on. There's not a lot of, you know, positive messages going on. I mean, the positiveness is in, you know, the parties right now, we're having a good time, hell yeah, but, and that's great, and that's awesome, but it's never really been who I am. It's, you know, a little bit more astral and a little bit more spiritual, you know,
sure.
and like to keep tabs on that and not ever let go of that, especially when writing lyrics, you know. And that's a hard thing to do. So it's just good to be working with somebody who has a, who, you know, who can be like, dude, that sounds really cheesy. You know, that sounds a little too hippie. You don't want to say that.
You've worked with some fixtures in the Denver scene, Blake from Tiger Party and Clark Smith of Dino Hunter. Who have you found really has it and has that piece that you want to be part of what you're doing and what your sound will evolve into and what it will become?
Yeah, like you said, you know, those two guys. Clark Smith from Dino Hunter, we really worked a lot on this project together. Just really by chance, kind of, you know, ended up that way, I guess. But really, we hit it off and really have a deep understanding of what we want the sound to be. And so we had done you know, he had helped me take a lot of my demos and basic ideas and stuff that me and Ashley had done and really, really evolve it. You know, he's so talented and has gone to school for music and music production, mm-hmm. which was really important. You know, like I said, everything I've learned has been self-taught. And so it's great to really work with someone who has gone to school and really spent and dedicated a large portion of their life to understanding music production.
Sure.
So that, and once again, same thing, we just really vibe and really kind of have a connection on where we see it going. So he's really, you know, outside of being a great saxophone player, has really, you know, we've worked a lot in the studio and on the production side of it. And he's been, that's been the biggest, you know. Well, outside of the guitar player, Matt Weiss, who lives in Atlanta, and who I've known for probably 15 years. Mm-hmm. We've done a Pink Floyd cover gig. And
sure.
He has been in a lot of, you know, more jam bands that have tried to make it over the years. And just one of those cats that is just so good. And you look at him, you're like, how has he never been in this band that's, you know, really blown up? Like so yeah. many musicians that we all know and that we see from time to time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's an integral part of the group.
Yeah.
Know, integral part. Because a lot of the songs, he's so great at adding just this, he's such an amazing guitar player, and he can do a lot of the great funk stuff, but he's just got this great dark style. He does the pedal steel. He just has a wide variety of things he can do on the guitar.
Sure.
And he's just an awesome player. So, you know, those two guys have played the biggest role. George Horn has been playing all the drums. He's in a couple, same thing, local bands, Kinetics, Analog Sun. He does gigs from time to time with the 40 Ounces to Freedom, the Sublime
tribute,
you know, tribute thing.
Sure.
Does a bunch of stuff around. He's just, same thing, you know, him and Clark went to school together along with a lot of these local musicians.
Got it.
I'm in town. And it's just, I mean, to me, hands down, best drummer in Denver. You know, it's just great. So it's just been fun working with a lot of different people. Gabe from the Motet did mm-hmm. some trumpet stuff on it.
That's fantastic.
You know, just, you know, have met a lot of great, you know, people and musicians since I've been here over the last year and a half or so. So it's just been awesome, you know. And being able to show it to people like Dom from Big Gigantic and some other musicians who I've known and trusted for years, you know what I mean? To be able to get feedback and advice and opinions on. It's
sure.
It's cool to be in this place to really be able to go out there and not ask for help, but just to, you know, it's all about getting as many people's opinions and advice as you can get. And not
Absolutely.
Thinking that you know the way it should be done and, you know, just putting your head in the sand and only doing it the way that you want to do it, you know? So it's been great to have a lot of different opinions and, you know, whether you take it all or not, doesn't. But it's good to always have all that feedback.
And you could put together all the the perfect instrumentals with great chops. You could put that together, but as a cohesive unit, can fans expect a certain level of improv, or is there a direction that you're heading that feels like it's focused on a specific vision of, you know, cohesive songwriting or this or that? Tell me a little bit about when the band is performing together, what is the singular guiding force here? Is it the songs? Is it you know, creating some sort of vibe? I wonder because, you know, you spent so much time
with them. The EP is about, you know, well, it's not about, but the EP, it covers, you know, it hits on different, you know, musical styles and, you know, it goes from some darker, more astral stuff to some poppier, more feel good, you know, song.
The balance, as we've spoken
about. It's got that balance. But, you know, so I always want to write and produce and create music from that point of view. But the live show for me is all about performance. It is once again about having that balance, you know, and it's about playing great songs. But more importantly, it's about having fun. You know, there will be elements of improv in there. And there's those rooms, you know, that space I was talking about, to take the risks, to create the magic, you know. But the live show, you know, I pride myself a lot with STS9 on, you know, always writing the set list and always, you know, a live show, for me, it's a concert, it's a performance. You're telling a story. There's a story arc there, and it's about, you know, developing your characters, setting the plot, the climax, the resolution, you know.
Sure.
It's all these peaks and valleys and not really just being one constant thing. So the live
show, a lot of that dance music is.
It's
just go, 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 go.
Here's your genre of music that you're playing, whether it's house, trap, dubstep, whatever, you know, and it's just pound people for an hour and a half with that one sound. It's like, to me, that's not, you know, that's great, you know, but that's not a concert.
Right.
That's not a performance, you know, like a play or like a opera that you would go see. It has these ebbs and flows. It builds you up. It settles you down. It makes you feel all these emotions. So that'll still be a huge part of what is happening.
Yeah.
You know, the show will be, obviously, you know, the songs that we've been writing, there'll still be a couple of STS9 songs in there from time to time, you know, that I've written, because I don't see any reason to not play music that I've written or
sure.
been a part of writing.
Yeah.
I think people enjoy that. Roger Waters doesn't not play Pink Floyd music just because he's not in Pink Floyd.
Exactly.
You know, there's nothing... if you're a part of something, I believe it's still important to share that with people.
And that's great for the fans, too.
And I don't hide from that or run from that, you know.
That's
great. I celebrate
great.
My time with STS9. You know, a cover from time to time, you know, especially some older funk stuff that I think people will enjoy, you know.
Sure.
Having that funk jam element is just, it's still important, you know. It's important for a lot. And especially to break up the monotony of... whether it's the more electronic stuff or the more dance stuff, you know, it's such a great way to open the show up, you know, and if you're going to put musicians on stage, great chops or not, you know, how are you going to not let them open up? How are you going to not let them get out there and get their piece from time to time and rip a good solo or, you
sure.
know, people want to see that, you know, and you spend your whole life honing your craft, you should be able to get up on stage and share that with people. You know, I think that's really important. So that'll be a big part of the show. And while there's a singer, there's not a singer the whole show. You know, I think it's great to have that, but, you know, she'll be doing other things musically as well besides singing. So that's important. You know what I mean? It's a band. It's not like, okay, here's our sax player, here's our singer, here, you know, it should be something that's cohesive and,
sure.
and that everybody's up there playing their part and doing their thing.
Yeah. And so, you know, sort of put a button on it. Do you see Seven Arrows as the true musical vision of David Murphy, or do you feel like Seven Arrows is a full unit that will be not only performing together but producing together and writing? I want to get sort of a sense of what it is as far as what you want it to be personally, but also the pieces involved want it to be.
Right now, I would say it's my vision, you know, along with Ashley and Matt, the guitar player.
Okay.
You know? But you know, that's, you know, and that's not saying anything against anyone else, but you
right.
know, that's just, it's how it started, you know, and I've gone out and asked these other people to kind of be, because I really enjoy what they do and I enjoy their opinions. I enjoy their musicianship and I enjoy what they have to bring to it. But like you said, they're also in a lot of other bands and mm-hmm. they do a lot of other things, you know?
Yeah.
You know, but this is still young. It's still in its infancy,
yeah.
you know, and I don't want to have to, you know, I want to let the music speak for itself, you know. People that enjoy the music and dig what's happening sonically, you know, then that's great. I will love getting that feedback from fans about what they like, what they don't like, and being able to continue to nurture those sides of it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it'll be playing to what people like and wanting to be successful, but I mean, you know, with STS9, through that same infancy period experimentation, you began to understand what people liked, what people enjoyed about what you did, and not out of wanting to do that for success, but out of wanting to continue to make people feel good, you continue to go in those avenues that people enjoy about, you know, what it is about what you do.
Right.
So at this point, I'm really excited to get some shows under the belt, you know, to get the music out there and to start to you know, enjoy getting that feedback, both positive and negative, or, you know, neutral, or whether they don't care for it one way or the other, you know.
Sure.
I think that's important, because it is a young thing. It's going to continue to grow and evolve, you know, and, you know, like art, it's like, some part of it is contrived and predetermined, because you can't create art without knowing what you want to go do. But
right.
there's also a side of it that you have to leave yourself wide open to what's going to happen. You know, life happens to you. Art happens to you. You can't go out there and force it. You can't go out there and say, I'm going to do this with my life, and only have your blinders on. You have to be open to what comes to you and what happens. And so that's where I see it being right now. You know, yeah, it is a full vision of myself, you know, and that's where it started, through me writing demos, knowing that I wanted to go in and get this musical and artistic thought out, you know, and then surrounding myself with people who could help me see that vision and who also believed in that vision.
Right.
You know, so we'll see where that road leads me, you know, leads us.
That's exciting. David Murphy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about this.
I really appreciate it, man. Thank you so much, man.
I want to thank David Murphy for coming and talking to me and being so open and honest. I really do appreciate that. You can catch his new project, Seven Arrows, at Concord Music Hall in Chicago this Friday, along with Dino Hunter and Inverse Universe. Tickets at silverwrapper.com. I'd like to also thank Dave Sheldon with Euphonic Conceptions. We will catch you soon right here on the UNS Podcast. Follow the UNS on Twitter @TheUNS and follow the UNS podcast @TheUNS podcast. We'll catch you soon.